This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 4th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 213 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Adam Labor, Monocle's man in Budapest, and also the man whose new book lifts the lid on the shadowy world of a particular Swiss bank. We'll be holding it to account later.
And we'll be on our bikes to learn about pedal power in Rwanda and how cycling's helped speed the nation from a troubled past to a brighter future with journalist and author Tim Lewis.
And speaking of journalists, we'll be joined by another one, Tim Finch, whose new work of fiction doesn't let news-hungry characters get in the way of a good story.
That's all to come, plus Tom Edwards will be here with the week's news and we'll enjoy some tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And we need to paint our listeners a picture of what's happening in the studio today because the sun has got his hat on, hip, 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 hooray, in brackets. Andrew and I are having a green short off, right?
Well, you've got more short off than I have.
I'm wearing a sawn-off shotgun.
Your shorts are kind of only just going past your cheeks, I think. They are short.
They're putting the sh in short. This is a Monocle-branded product I'm wearing. This is the Monocle swimming trunk.
Okay.
I mean, they're not actually like pants.
Turned into a Sunday short.
Yeah. Well, it's warm outside. I did a spot of sunbathing before we started the show.
People thought you were a go-go dancer when you arrived. A retired one, but a go-go dancer nonetheless. Well, you look very nice.
It's been all right? And yeah. It's nice that we've got the weather back in order to wear these green shorts. And how's everything been? I don't think I've been on the show for a couple of weeks. How's been holding the fort? We've both been on holiday, in fact.
Yeah, so I had Sophie Grove here on the show last week with me, and that was very enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then we've had quite an okay week, haven't we?
It's been a kind of chilled, nice sort of week.
It's
taking stock, commissioning the next issue, la la la. It's been all right.
Not too crazy. And then we're kind of building up to the fact that the book's coming out, which I keep on mentioning.
But
that's we're going to get some copies in here, I believe, at the end of August and post them out to our subscribers then. But it's going to be on the bookshelves in September.
I'm looking forward to that.
I am as well.
And we've got a journalist-packed show.
Yes.
I don't know whether I'm prepared for this. I feel kind of like in holiday humour again, now the sun's come out. We need some people to presumably put some sort of journalistic lead back in our pencil. Maybe these are the men to do it.
Indeed, Rob. We shall be meeting lots of fine people, and I'm sure we can change gear once or twice during the show. But that's what we've been up to at Midori House. And now it's time for Tom Edwards with next week's News Look Ahead.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly, the ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio, it's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
Man alive, that's quite an introduction, Tom. I feel like we should be filling the studio with dry ice for you.
It would be fitting, wouldn't it? I always feel just I can't live up to that billing.
You always have a very pained look on your face while it's playing.
I find him quite intimidating, old Tommy Edwards.
Jack Phillips also did a very nice light show. You have a green and an orange light here. No one really knows what the orange light is for. Maybe it means stop talking. I get a lot of that.
Exactly. There it goes again.
Anyway, so that was a kind of a triumphalist walk down the gantry.
Absolutely.
Into
and now
the ring.
I'm primed and ready for my heavyweight bout.
Where are you going to begin?
Well, there are lots of important things happening today. For example, Iran's new president-elect, Hassan Rouhani, taking his oath of office before parliament. Important. Big issues.
Big issues.
But for me, something else caught my eye today. Japan is launching the world's first space conversation robot.
Right.
Okay.
So what's that? It's going to chat into space and see what comes back?
No, it's more important than that. So it's being launched from the Tanegashima Space Center. It's called Kirobot.
I've been there, Tanegashima.
Yeah.
Do you remember I went there?
Yes.
So I bought the space food
back. So you'll know all about this.
Yeah. In fact, you still have a little rocket behind you.
I do have a little rocket behind my desk, which someone's taken the stand off, I noticed.
Well, see, this is perfect for you.
Yeah.
Because you've got a sense of how lonely life can be for an astronaut when you were there. I don't know what kind of facilities you inspected. But Kirobo is going up to keep Koichi Wakata company on the International
Space
Station.
Oh, that's nice. So he's like a big teddy bear.
So it's the first ever time this has happened. Japan are trying to sort of catch up. They say, you know, Russia was the first in outer space, the US first on the moon. We're the first to send a robot astronaut to space that can communicate. He's smaller than most robots in space. Apparently there are quite a few. Because he doesn't need to do any physical work.
He's just a chat bot.
He's just for chat. So he's only about a foot tall. He weighs 1 kilo. But he has voice functions, facial recognition.
Wow.
So if Koichi is feeling sad, then...
he's just a chat. So he's basically...
Kirobo
like,
will speak to
they've
him.
They basically turned Steve Bloomfield into a robot and send him to space.
Well, Steve Bloomfield's away at the moment.
I said it.
That's why the question will be asked. The only thing that makes me slightly edgy about this is, you know, I've seen 2001.
Yeah.
Robots in space, for me... That
a
puts
bit
me
eerie.
On edge. Yeah.
But then also R2-D2, you give him a hug.
He was friendly, wasn't he?
R2-D2, Hal, or K9, which is the most...
Spectrum.
Out of those three, which robot would you like to take to your spaceship to
probably
keep you company?
Probably K9.
Yeah, me too. Andrew?
Well, Hal's a bit too big to take anywhere, isn't he?
Yeah, he's also...
You wouldn't want him there.
He's a
well.
Bastard.
He's a dangerous character.
No, but this little fellow, will he come back again? Or are they just going to leave him up there?
He won't be like poor Laika, the tragic one, the beautiful
the dog that
Russian
they sent into space.
Space dog. Just little bones floating around somewhere.
Mm.
Like Major Tom, Kirobo will be back. I wonder if he'll get a ticker tape welcome when he returns.
Might get his own show.
I've only gone and got totally my own show, like Chantal Housen from Big Brother.
Let's book him as a guest now.
I would love to speak to him personally and professionally.
Okay.
Anyway, I thought that was quite.
I love him.
Tune.
I wish. I'm going to quickly Google a picture of what he looks like.
He just looks like
while
a little
talking.
Space astronaut robot.
Exactly. You don't know how to turn
I literally
that
didn't
on.
Even know how to use it.
But that was frothy. I enjoyed something slightly more serious.
I like frothy.
It's frothy. On Tuesday, so Detroit, it's been...
So you've got new boss in Iran, Japanese chatbot.
Chatbot.
Light and shade. Where are we going next?
We're going to Detroit.
Okay.
Been the news, obviously, declared, filed for bankruptcy protection, the biggest city in the US to do that. And they've had this emergency financial manager who's trying to pull in the purse strings for the next 18 months. But this week, on Tuesday, there will be a sort of preliminaries to try and pick the next mayor. And obviously, this is a big deal because all these emergency measures will be in place. The idea being that a new man, approved by the community, well, these primaries will reveal two candidates to face off, who will then be the mayor going forward to try and move the city forwards and lose some of its bad rep.
And neither are going to be able to promise to do that much.
Well, this is the problem. They're already hamstrung by that, you would imagine. And it's even more embarrassing than that. One of the favourites to succeed is a local political figure called Mike Duggan, who is well-fancied.
I went to school with someone called Mike Duggan.
Well, funnily enough, this is not wholly irrelevant in the case of this story. So Mike Duggan was quite fancied to... He was thrown off the ballot because of a technicality, but it was thought he was making great numbers in the polls. He was going to be back. Another Mike Duggan, possibly your school friend...
Wow.
Also appeared and filed to stand as a write-in candidate. He's also called Mike Duggan, but it's spelled Dudgeon, but it's pronounced the same way. And obviously, with a write-in candidate, the only condition you have to meet to get votes that are written in is that the voter's intention is clear.
Right.
So if someone who's not the best at spelling writes in and says, I'm voting for Mike Duggan, there's no way whether it was Dudgeon or Duggan. And of course, then this would all go through the courts. We've seen before in America.
What's the second? What's Dudgeon then? Is he just an anarchist? Is he just
want to
like?
Yeah.
Cause
Do you want to know
of...
what he said? He said, I want to stir things up.
Yeah.
So from the sublime to the ridiculous, and a lot of people in Detroit are saying, look, we've got to try and restore the city's credibility. And this is not the way to go about it. So they may not even get their candidate selected. Far less give them the power to actually make any meaningful difference once.
And I'd imagine Detroit hasn't been spending that much money on its education, maybe. So there's probably more misspellers in Detroit than anywhere else.
Well, it's certainly going to be competitively bad. So a bit of a shambles.
They should make Sisto Rodriguez the mayor of Detroit, surely. He's the most famous son of Detroit at the moment. Everyone loves him.
A unity candidate.
Unity!
Exactly. Be good advice for them. But I just fear that Detroit
may...
Or
Stevie Wonder. A Motown hit. I don't mean our little Stevie Wonder, because he's gone up to space.
He can't do anything. He could communicate from there. He'd certainly have the world's attention. I've got more serious ones. We don't want to do that. How about this one? Next Saturday, this is one of my favourite events. It's the National Hobo Convention. This has happened every year since 1900. Now, give me a second. In Britt, Iowa, the local Chamber of Commerce celebrates the American travellers. It's an incredible thing, hobos. It's not just about sort of vagrants. The hobo rail riders. There's this real amazing kind of counterculture in the States. Lots of very big cultural figures who used to ride the railroads. And they all get together in Brit for the last 113 years. There's plenty of fun things that happen. They will have a big stew.
So
a big stew.
So a tenant super drinking competition.
No, a ladies' tea party.
Shouting at squirrels in the park.
Possibly election of the hobo king and queen. Have you got a favourite hobo? Either of you? I've got a few candidates.
Well, Jack Carrot would be my favourite sort of railroad riding.
Yeah, Jack Carrot, of course. For those of the sporting bent, Jack Dempsey,
really?
Former world heavyweight champion, used to ride the rails. So many more. More contemporary. C6 Steve.
Yep.
Musician.
Yeah, he did indeed.
And a lot of these people are kind of professional railroaders. Like, they'll actually hold down jobs and they'll not necessarily be destitute.
When I went to the fish and chip shop at the top of my road in Islington the other day, they gave me a food parcel. And I thought, that's probably time to cut my hair.
Maybe you should take to the rails.
Yeah, maybe take to the rails.
You should go to the Hobo Convention.
Overground. Try it on the Overground first. Keep it in London.
Get a fast train to Iowa. I think you'd fit in perfectly.
Yeah.
And that is.
Andrew's going, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Get a haircut as well.
I might even pay for the ticket.
Oh, God. Tom Edwards, thank you so much. I think you lived up to the dry ice. I think you lived up to the light show. And you lived up to the other Tom Edwards' sort of histrionic welcome to the show. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure as always.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be peeking behind the scenes of world banking after this. Adam Labor is a name that may be familiar to regular Monocle 24 listeners as our Budapest correspondent, but his new book, the problematically American punning title of Tower of Basel, or Basel maybe as they say in Switzerland, focuses on something much less familiar, Switzerland's Bank for International Settlements.
Operating since 1930, its role is often shrouded in mystery. Accountable to no particular government, the BIS has just 140 customers but made tax-free profits of $1.1 billion in 2012. And the decisions that come from its meetings at a Basel HQ affect monetary policy across the globe.
And Adam joins us now on the Monocle Weekly. So the book is The Tower of Basel, the shadowy conspiracy of the secret bank that runs the world. That's a nice subtitle. Does it live up to the spooky Bilderberg group subtitle?
Actually, it's the shadowy history, not the shadowy conspiracy.
See, there I go. See, I'm putting words in. That's exactly where you've got me. But does that sort of subtitle help? It's a nice subtitle to have on a book all about a big bank, especially over the last 5 years when we trust them less, especially central banks.
Well, we trust them much less. The thing about the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, is the most important bank in the world that you've almost certainly never heard of. Most people have never heard of the BIS, yet behind the scenes, it's been extremely influential in modern history, and it's helped shape the modern global financial system and helped shape the modern world right from the 1930s to the present day.
Perhaps you just tell us a little bit about that history, because it kind of comes out of like German reparations after the First World War. It's a kind of a clearinghouse for that. And then it kind of sticks around. Then it gets Merkel involved in the Second World War as well.
Yes, I mean, the BIS was founded in 1930 as a means of managing German reparations payments for the First World War, the money that the Germans had to pay. But, of course, by 1932, and especially by 1933, when Hitler came to power, Germany wasn't paying anyone anything. So they stopped their reparations payments, but the bank went from strength to strength, because the real reason the BIS was set up was to have a place where central bankers could meet away from prying journalists and away from politicians. And the BIS is really unique because it is a commercial bank. For example, last year, it only has 140 customers, but last year it made £900 million profits, tax-free.
Sounds like Rob.
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is you've got to do your expenses at the right time.
Yeah. Yes, you have. You've got to do your expenses at the right time. So it was protected. It's supremely protected by this whole carapace of legal immunities. And then during the 1930s, it helped organise some of the world's first bailouts to Spain and Austria and Hungary. And if you've ever wondered how we managed to get to this situation, for example, when you look at Greece today, the guys fly in from the European Central Bank and the IMF, and they call them the Troika. Mm. And you think, how did we actually get here, that these men in suits can fly into a country and tell democratically elected governments what to do? Well, it all started at the BIS. But during the Second World War, it became much more sinister because the BIS was the place where the Allies and the Nazis had secret contacts to do their post-war planning for the world after the Second World War. Now, we all have this idea of the Second World War as total war, both sides going all out to destroy each other for victory. Well, yes, it was on one level, but it was not in Basel. In Basel, the channels were kept open. The bank was run by an American called Thomas McKittrick. His deputy was a German called Paul Hechler, who was a Nazi, a member of the Nazi Party. His correspondence can be seen in the BIS archives. He signs it Heil Hitler. The manager of the bank was a Frenchman. There was also British people working there and Italians, all working happily together to keep the money channels.
So just they were planning for life after the Second World War. But yes. Did they know what they were planning for, though? Did they already at that point know that the Germans were kind of doomed, or did they think that actually there was going to be a German victory?
No, I think it was pretty clear. I mean, there's no one smarter than bankers and money men knowing which way the wind is blowing politically. So after Stalingrad especially, it was clear that it was over for the Germans. So they were planning for a German defeat. But I found these amazing documents in the archives in America, American intelligence documents, because Thomas McKittrick was an agent of Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the American wartime intelligence chief based in Basel, who later went on to run the CIA. And Roger Aubouin, the French manager of the bank, was also an agent of Alan Dulles. And they were passing him information about what the Germans were up to. And I found these documents that Thomas McKittrick, about him in the American archives, whereas McKittrick is in contact with German industrialists in 1944 and saying to them, look, when we come in, behave yourselves. We won't destroy your business. In fact, we'll guarantee your profits after the Second World War is over if you cooperate with us. So I thought this was really shocking, because McKittrick's an American citizen and he's cutting deals with German industrialists in 1944. But this wasn't some kind of random idea of his to go and do this. He was doing this with the full knowledge of the State Department, it's clear from the documents, and the full knowledge of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the American intelligence organization. So you can see that even while American and British and Canadian and Australian boys 18, 19 are landing on the beaches in Normandy and being machine gunned, these guys in Basel are cutting their deals with the German business people to, you know, make sure that the German economy survives the Second World War.
And not wanting to harp constantly on about Germany, the parallel was drawn from your book, I think in one of the reviews of it, that the sort of financial dealings during the war and certainly just post the war are very similar. The way that they've been conducted and the style of them and the strategy, the financial strategy involved, is very similar to how the European Union has been made and how it's going, the federalism of it at the moment.
Yes, the BIS has been absolutely crucial for the European Union because before the euro was introduced in the end of the 1990s, it took decades of planning, because you can't just ram all these currencies together. What you have to do for a long time was bring down the exchange rate fluctuations so the mark's not jumping around against the lira, so the franc is stable against the peseta. And so all of that technical stuff, that was all happening at the BIS for 50 years. And then in 1994, the general manager of the BIS, a man called Alexandre Lamfalussy, set up something called the European Monetary Institute at the BIS to manage this convergence of the currencies. And then the EMI left Basel and went to Frankfurt and became the European Central Bank. So the European Central Bank is the son of the BIS, and interestingly is also founded by an international treaty. It's also very unaccountable. Its operations are quite obscure, and you see a continuity there.
Yeah, the accountability thing is really fascinating. In the introduction to the book, you paint a nice picture of walking around Basel, seeing this building, this handsome Herzog and de Meuron tower that's 2 or 3 years old, I guess, and of constant lunches, the wining and dining that is done with the 10 most powerful men, and they are men, as you say, normally in the world, that is done there. What is the vibe of the place? Because they have sort of practically diplomatic immunity.
It's a very strange vibe. I mean, actually, it's a 18-foot tower block. It's circular. And
18 stories or 18 foot?
Oh,
quite short, 18 foot, isn't it?
Yeah, 18 stories.
It's a very tiny bit tower block, eh?
18-story tower block.
The chimney of Basel.
Yeah, 18 stories. And it's a very strange vibe because, as you say, it has the same status almost as the UN or the IMF or an embassy. So it's very high security. But when you go in, it was built in 1977. And it feels completely retro 1970s. They've got all this weird orange and green globular furniture that's in pristine condition, of course, because we're in Switzerland and it's all been very well looked after. And these long, looping, circular corridors. And you really feel, if, you know, when you're walking around one of these corridors, that, you know, Blofeld is going to appear from one of the rooms and stroke his cat or something. But they keep you under very tight leash in there. Now, I give them credit. Their archives are very good and they're open. under the 30-year rule. So anything up to 30 years ago, a bona fide researcher can go there. And they gave me everything I asked for. And that's how I found out a lot of the murky stuff about the Second World War. But when you're in the archives, you're not allowed to move around the building on your own. You're allowed to go to the toilet or get a cup of coffee from the machine like 5 yards away. That's it. If you go to the library, you're escorted to the library. You can do what you want in the library. Then you must call and be escorted back. You can't go anywhere without an escort. And
but this is presumably for a matter of sort of security, as you would be in an embassy, rather than because you're going to see Mervyn King kind of. Well, no, I don't even know. What do you think Mervyn might be doing?
We don't know what he might
having,
be doing.
Having a second glass of wine with lunch.
Yeah. Have you had any reaction from people who work at the bank to
not
your writings?
Word. Not a word. No, nothing yet.
They've closed your account.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they've closed my account.
For them, there goes
you were, well, you were, actually, you can't have 140 customers.
You can't have a private account at the BIS unless you work there.
But maybe you could just tell us, you know, that there is it's nice for the book to be this air of conspiracy, and you know, for there certainly does seem to be some kind of very complicated dealings in their past. But do you think that we've all become to be just so suspicious of anything to do with finance these days that you, as a journalist, also have a kind of bit of a responsibility as well to kind of say when they're not being kind of murky and actually to say they are doing an interesting role here? What was the balance between trying to, you know, obviously put out a great book, but also kind of tell really the story of what they do?
Well, I made great efforts to get that balance right. And after the Second World War, I mean, the darkest part of the history is clearly the Second World War. And nowadays, it's not so conspiratorial, but there's still a lot of questions. I mean, every 2 months, the world's 60 most important central bankers meet at the BIS. That includes Ben Bernanke, Mark Carney, Mario Draghi from the European Central Bank. And they meet and they discuss the global financial crisis. And one of them, Mervyn King, actually gave me an interview, and he told me in the discussions that the BIS have been very useful to discuss policy instruments for dealing with the crisis, and we're in a new place, and we all have to try and work out new means of reducing the fever. But we don't know what happens in these discussions. We don't know who attends them. We know who probably attends them, but we don't know who actually attends them. We don't know what's discussed at these meetings. We don't know what policy instruments are discussed. And my point is that these bankers have got the best of both worlds. It's a commercial bank. It's extremely profitable. You know, it's a AAA gilt-plated rating, but it's got the same protected status as the UN or an embassy, and everything that happens there is very confidential. So,
Presumably, these central bankers are playing with public money. This isn't
their
own
and that's
money.
The other point. That's the other point, that the central bankers there, I mean, you can say, of course, JP Morgan doesn't have to tell us what it's doing. It's a commercial organisation. But the central bankers there are dealing with national money supplies. They're public servants. We want to know who's at these meetings and what they're talking about. And when I said to them, you know, what about more transparency? They say, you know, they always shift it to a very ridiculous level. They say, oh, well, if you put a camera in the room and put it on YouTube, nobody would say anything. I said, I'm not saying you have to put a camera in the room and put it on YouTube. Obviously, no one's going to say anything, but
they don't have minutes, for example, do they? None of the meetings have minutes.
None. You could do what the Federal Reserve does. Like 2 weeks later, you could say, these were the people who attended the meetings, and this is the broad theme of discussion. You know, you could make a gesture towards transparency and accountability, but none of that's really happening.
Would you watch if it was on YouTube? Because I have a fear that it might not get quite as many hits as it's Gangnam Style, right?
No, I don't think it would get as many hits as Gangnam Style. And I don't think it would ever be on, you know, I don't think it's likely to be on YouTube. But, I mean, the interesting thing is, if you type in BIS, Federal Reserve, you know, bi-monthly meetings, what comes up from the Fed website is they'll tell you who from the Federal Reserve is going to the meetings, when do they arrive in Basel, how long are they staying, which meetings are they going to in the bank, and which room the meetings are in, and how long the meetings last. And, you know, guess what? The dollar hasn't collapsed, and neither has the BIS collapsed. So there's clearly a lot more room for transparency.
When I was researching the book to interview before this interview, Adam, I typed that in a couple of days ago, and I've had a man in a sedan and dark glasses following me around.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think
that might be my book publicist.
The subtitle, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World, is the subtitle to The Tower of Basel, or Basel, as we might
Well, we're
it.
British.
Yeah, exactly.
Basel.
Adam Labore, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And it's time for some music now. And because the sun's back out in London, we're going to play something that's been sort of around the periphery of the Monocle 24 playlist. It's new from the James Taylor Quartet. It is from the Sunshine EP, The Sun Shines Into My Life. Sun Shines Into My Life, new from JTQ, right here on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to be speaking to Tim Lewis about cycling in Rwanda.
Get ready to go deep underground, because beneath our feet are some of the greatest engineering marvels on the planet. All next week on the Globalist and Globalist Asia programs, we'll be donning the hard hat for our series all about tunnels. From the longest tunnel in the world, currently under construction through the Swiss Alps, to the construction site at the bottom of the Bosphorus. Yeah, you know they're gonna bring it down now. We'll be hitching a ride with one of the giant diggers burrowing its way under London for the Crossrail project. And we'll also be traversing a dangerous network of tunnels in the Middle East to find out what it's like smuggling not only goods, but people in and out of the Gaza Strip. So join us next week for our special series on tunnels around the world. That's on the Globalist at 1400 hours in Tokyo, 0600 hours in London, and 2200 hours in Los Angeles.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Cycling is not the first pastime that one might associate with Rwanda, but the Central African nation, which was ripped apart by genocide in the 1990s, has often struggled with its defining image ever since.
Tim Lewis is a journalist and author inspired by Rwanda's passion for cycling. From the story of Rwandan Olympic hopeful Adrian Niyonshuti to ex-Tour de France winner Jock Boyer, who now calls the country home and steers its national team, Lewis has put a collection of stories together to show a nation emerging onto the international stage. He joined Monocle's Steve Bloomfield a little earlier.
Tim, welcome to Monocle 24 and congratulations on the book.
Hi, Steve.
Before we start, we should probably be clear about this. The story about the Rwandan cycling team has been written about once or twice before in magazine articles, one of which you commissioned when you were at The Observer, and which I wrote.
This is all sounding very insidery now, isn't it?
But just to be clear, this is a subject that both of us know a little bit about. Rwanda's cycling team, when you think about it, and I think this might have been the line I gave you when I tried to originally pitch it to you, it's a little bit Cool Runnings, the idea, isn't it? It's, you know, just as Jamaica and the bobsleigh sounds a bit incongruous, so does, to many outsiders, Rwanda and cycling. And yet, when you go to Rwanda, it's very, very clear that cycling is an integral part of that country and that culture.
Mm. I think that was very much the pitch that you gave, and it was certainly a pitch that I gave to my publishers to try and get it commissioned. But a real sort of turning point for me was when I first went to Rwanda in 2010 to attend the Tour of Rwanda cycling race there. And it was clear that, as you say, bicycles are a hugely integral part of that country. And there were a few things that were really obvious just from that first trip, which is, one, the Rwandan cyclists had incredible natural talent, and if they were given the right opportunities, they could potentially be very talented cyclists. I think the other thing that was quite clear was that there seemed to be a really interesting dynamic between the Rwandan cyclists and the kind of money men, if you like, these two Americans who'd come in and were funding this team, and one of whom, an ex-pro cyclist called Jock Boyer, who was coaching the team. And then I think the final thing that really appealed to me about and became very obvious when I was there for the Tour de Rwanda was that it really was a microcosm of the country at that stage. It was a country that was very keen to try and move on from people just talking about it in terms of the genocide. And the bicycle team, in some senses, was a real hopeful operation that no one really thought should work, but was going okay.
And this was something that the cyclists themselves talked about as well, wasn't it? That it was this idea that Rwanda was known for something horrible that had happened in its past, and that there needed to be a new story to be told about the country.
Absolutely. I think the cyclists come from a really interesting generation. I think Philip Gurevich has called it the interim generation, because they were all around at the time of the genocide. Most of them were aged like 7, 8, 9, and 10, which places them in an interesting position because they remember the events, but they aren't implicated in them. So they have this perspective of knowing what's happened, trying to sort of change the narrative for Rwanda.
Now, you've called the book Land of Second Chances, and those second chances aren't just for Rwanda and aren't just for the cyclists, but for the two men that you mentioned before, the two Americans that helped set up the team. Tell us a bit more about them.
Well, there are two main figures. The reason there is a Rwandan cycling team that we're talking about now and that races across Africa is because in 2005, Tom Ritchie went to Rwanda in the middle of having a midlife crisis.
And Tom Ritchie was the guy who essentially created the mountain bike.
Yeah, he was basically the designer of the mountain bike back in California in the late 70s. And he is very familiar to people who like bikes. If you go into any bike shop in the world, you will find probably some part that he has either designed himself or directly influenced. So he is a very successful man, a millionaire many times over, lives in Silicon Valley. So he's an affluent guy who suddenly was left by his wife, went to Rwanda, and was trying to make sense of his life. And when he arrived there, he saw lots of people cycling. He saw lots of really, really naturally talented athletes. And a sort of light bulb went off. He thought, you know, maybe we could do a team here.
And of course, then he needed someone to run that team.
And the guy he brought in to run that team was someone who he used to race with when he was growing up, when he was a teenager in California, called Jock Boyer. And Jock Boyer, again, is quite well known in cycling circles because he was the first American to race the Tour de France back in 1981. And was, a sort of a pioneer of the sport. He slightly gets forgotten about because shortly after him, Greg LeMond came and won it. But he was the original American in Europe.
The original American in Europe, but then by the time he came to Rwanda, his story had changed somewhat, hadn't it?
Yeah, in 2003, he was convicted as a sexual offender and he was served 8 months in prison. And so he came out and didn't really know what to do with his life. And this is where the element of second chances came in. Tom Ritchie thought he deserved a second chance and asked Jock if he wanted to run this bicycle team. Jock didn't probably have a lot of options open to him at that stage. I'm not sure there were too many American teams or European teams who would have taken him on. But he had this amazing amount of sort of knowledge and expertise. He had gone from America to Europe at a time when not that many people did that. And he had a really tough experience. He'd had to kind of learn the sport a really hard way. And here was the chance to do something like that in Rwanda, bring these cyclists through, not a completely different way from how he had experienced in the 70s.
When the team came together, when I was there in 2008, they had their uniforms, they looked great, they were competing in tours around Africa. I think they'd just come back from Gabon when I first met them. And Jock, and this was something shared by the riders as well, had very big ambitions. It was, we want to have someone at the London Olympics in 2012, and we want to have the first African cyclist at the Tour de France.
Mm. Well, they did these physiological tests on the first riders that you'd have met and spoken to then, and their results were really sort of off the charts. I mean, as good as European professionals. And so at that stage, which I imagine was probably a very optimistic stage, it was like, why wouldn't these guys get to the Olympics? Why wouldn't they ride in the Tour de France?
And this is, I guess, why it wasn't really similar to Jamaica and bobsleigh, because actually these guys were very, very good. They just hadn't had the training, the coaches, for a lot of time, the equipment.
Absolutely. I mean, the elements where it did have the Cool Runnings idea was they did have these colourful uniforms. They'd turn up at events and people were like, what are these guys doing? I mean, it's such a rarity. I mean, it's a bizarre thing to realise, but a black rider had never competed in the Tour de France until 2011. So we're only talking 2 years ago. And before that, there'd never, ever been a black rider in the race. There's still never been a black African. It's this sport, cycling, which is very strange. It's been dominated for such a long time by a very small part of Northern Europe and Spain and Italy. It's a sport that's changing, and I think that's where this fits into it, because there's no reason why African riders shouldn't do really well in the biggest races.
And when we look at those riders that could, a few years ago there were a number of members of the team, Team Rwanda, who would certainly talk big and hope that they were going to be the ones that would make it. Of those original team members, what's happened to them, and have any of them actually achieved those goals?
So I think when you went there, there were five original team members. And this is where the story for me became really interesting, because it isn't a simple question of getting a really physically talented rider, putting him on a bike and just going, whoa, okay, fantastic, this guy's going to be racing at the Tour de France. Because that's happened for one athlete, Adrian, who was one of the five members who did make it to the Olympics in 2012. He competed in the mountain biking. He's now contracted to big South African team, which has become the first African team to race in Europe. And he is hopeful. He's 26, 27 now, and he's hopeful that he will ride in some of those big races in the next couple of years. But for the rest of them, it's a more complicated story. And I think this is something you see across Africa. People come in with excellent intentions, a lot of money, a lot of commitment. And there are certain cultural misunderstandings, almost, if you like. It was quite rare that they seized upon Adrian and Adrian got their dreams, because they said to them, oh, you know, you guys can race in the Tour de France. And the five riders that you met, they'd have never heard of the Tour de France. They wouldn't have been able to imagine what it was like. And so it took a lot for Adrian to grasp that and think, oh, okay, yeah, I can understand how this could be good for me. The rest of them were probably just thinking about, is this going to get me some money? Is this going to get me some money for my family? How is this going to affect the people that I have to support? Their ideas of what they're in the sport for were much more localized. They didn't really care about staying in fancy hotels or traveling to different countries. What was most important to them was their family and looking after them. And, you know, it's a cultural leap. I mean, Adrian got it, and the four other riders that you met probably didn't get it to the same extent. They were not as ambitious.
There was one line I remember from Jock Boyer when I first met him. He talked about difficulties with timekeeping and how it could sometimes be a bit of a struggle to make sure that everyone got to training on time or turned up at the camps on time. He said, I even bought them watches, but that still hasn't helped at all. There were, as you alluded to, that lots of cultural differences here, weren't there, between and still are between an American coach and a Rwandan team. Was there ever going to be any chance that those cultural differences could be erased or at least dealt with?
I don't know, and I think it depends on what you look at as being a success for the project. I think probably they went in with very ambitious aims. They imagined a whole team of Rwandan riders riding the Tour de France in 10 years. That's not going to happen, and that, you know, that may never happen. And I think it's interesting that you know it's funny that when we talk about it, I mean, I think it was a comic aside in your piece about how Jock bought them watches. It didn't make any difference. They missed their flights. Their plane would be taking off in 15 minutes and they wouldn't have packed their bags and they'd just be sitting there leisurely having lunch somewhere. And at that point, I think it was comic. But as you move on, it becomes, from the coach's perspective, it becomes frustrating. They can't understand why they are giving these riders this a chance of a lifetime, this chance to really, really change their lives, earn proper money. And they just think, why don't these guys understand that? You know, but for them, and this comes out to you when you spend more time with the riders, speaking to them through translators, I was never sure that their dreams always matched up with the dreams of the Americans. They were not sitting there. They might have been told, I want to race in the Tour de France. They might even parrot that back to you. But you didn't really get the sense that that's what they believed. They would like a house for themselves. They'd like to help out as many members of their families as possible. And they'd probably like to not be farmers. But those were the extent of their ambitions to some extent. And so asking them to suddenly go, oh, I really want to go to France and race my bicycle, that's an alien concept to them.
Where does this story end? Because obviously, as we mentioned, Adrian, the star of the team, makes it to the 2012 Olympics. But for the team as a whole, where are they now? What hopes are there for the future?
The Team Rwanda is still going. In fact, it's widened the pool significantly. So there's a lot of riders. Adrian, again, the most successful one, has set up an academy in his hometown, which is bringing through younger people. There's a lot of equipment that they'd have never had. There's races set up. So, I mean, in a certain sense, it is still a good news story. But I'd also, and I think this is just reality, and this is interesting for me, that it isn't just a simple, hey, this is great, you know, this is gonna change all these people's lives. And it's a more complicated story than that. But I think what is undeniable is that across Africa, there are various programs going on in different countries. Eritrea is mad about cycling. I mean, obviously, it's an Italian colony and former Italian colony, obviously. And the culture of cycling is so ingrained there. They have very many professionals and lots of local races. And their best riders are now starting to make it into Europe. So I think it is undeniably a fact that we will start seeing sub-Saharan Africans racing in Europe. They'll be much more visible. One of them will break through and race in the Tour de France in the next couple of years. And, you know, possibly down the line they could win it. It's very hard to predict with cycling. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, if you'd said a British person would have won the Tour de France, no one would have believed you. So these things can change more quickly than you'd imagine they would.
That was Steve Bloomfield speaking to author and journalist Tim Lewis.
And we'll be learning how to get even more drama out of journalism in a moment, just after this.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's the menu, in association with Krug.
They say that an author has a whole lifetime to draw the inspiration for their first novel, but it's the following up that's the challenge. Luckily, our final guest, ex-BBC Westminster correspondent and now communications director of think tank the Institute for Public Policy Research, Tim Finch, has hopefully lived through more than enough exciting stories to fill a few weighty tomes.
His debut novel, The House of Journalists, tells the story of a London address housing a cast of misplaced writers fleeing oppressive regimes. And Tim joins us now to tell us where facts meet fiction. So first of all, you have a background in the world of refugees as well. So you understand the idea of people being displaced and their stories kind of getting jumbled up and lost and thrown together with other people in similar situations. Was that the kind of the seed for the novel?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, one of the things I think really struck me when I was working as Director of Communications at the Refugee Council was that I came across a lot of refugee writers. Some of them were writing fiction, memoirs, that sort of thing. It became almost a subgenre in itself. And as slightly warped as it might sound, I suffered from a degree of writer's envy. I just thought, well, they've written these books, they've got this epic experience they can draw on. They're being talked about and published, and I'd always wanted to write a novel. And I thought, well, but I haven't got anything to write about. You know, I have a very safe and secure life. I'm from the south of England, and I've always been fairly prosperous. And nothing much has happened. And then it occurred to me, of course, well, fiction, it doesn't have to have happened to you. You can just steal it off other people. So in one sense, really, all I've done is steal refugees' stories and put them into a fictional situation. Of course, at the same time, I'm slightly satirising that whole process. So it's a real cake and eat it novel, really, in that sense.
And was this sounds like a sort of friendly shark pool, but a shark pool nonetheless, the sort of pool of journalists that were in Westminster and then at the Refugee Council, presumably trying to outdo each other and where they'd been, and the stories that they had to tell are other people's stories that they had in the memory banks, right?
I guess so. I mean, I'm a great believer that journalists are rather less backbiting and vicious than popular imagination sometimes makes them out to be. And partly because I spend a lot of my life in that world, and so a lot of my friends are like that. And so there's a bit of that. And obviously, and one of the things that comes out in the House of Journalists, I hope, is that refugees, all they have is their story. And if you want to get an asylum claim processed and get status in this country, you've got to get your story together. That's the, you know, almost literally the difference between life and death. So that can be quite competitive. But let's put it this way, that the book has got quite a dark, bleak, satiric edge to it. And it's in a slightly heightened reality. It doesn't reflect the worlds I moved in. It wasn't quite as dark as that.
Yeah, House of Journalists doesn't sound, I mean, in the current environment, the post-Levinson environment, the House of Journalists sounds like a house that not many people that read newspapers or watch the TV news or radio news would maybe want to move into, right?
No, I mean, I think there's...
Did you choose the title with care? Were you slightly trepidatious about it now?
No, the title's an interesting thing because I was at a Refugee Council event in Bristol. I remember it very distinctly. And someone told me there was this place called the Maison des Journalistes in Paris. And I thought, oh, House of Journalists, that would be a good... I actually thought it would be a good title for a book long before I had the idea for it. And I stored it away and then I used it. Someone asked me recently whether I must have done some research, presumably about this Maison des Journalistes. I think there's a place in Russia that's similar as well. And I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't believe in research for novels. I think you should just make it all up. And I haven't even checked the website, so I don't know what it's like. But there is a feeling that if you put journalists and writers in a enclosed space, then something is going to happen. If you read it, you'll find that it's a place actually not very real, in the sense that it's rather a stylish Georgian terrace type house, which has been kitted out in a very nice way. Now, that's not usually the type of buildings in which refugees live in this country, but I wanted to do that for effect. And so that initially you're thinking, what a great place, wouldn't, if you were an exiled writer, wouldn't you want to be there? And gradually it closes in and closes in and becomes more and more oppressive.
Now, we're saying that this is your debut novel. Tell me, when you start typing, how many goes did it take before you began to find the voice? Because it's a very unusual voice, I think, for a first novel.
Well, yeah, I mean, it isn't a voice. It's a multiple voice novel, and it moves out of all sorts of. I mean, there's a we type chorus there. I move in and out of the first and the third person. I use sort of bureaucratese or officialese, a rather bland, dead style, to create that slightly oppressive effect. At other times, there's a character that has this very Latinate demotic, if you can have such a thing. So there's a huge variety of styles in there. And in one sense, it's about that. It's about the issue of finding a voice, which, you know, all creative writing courses tell you you've got to do. One way round it is to hedge your bets and try for loads of them, which is what I've done, I think. But in terms of that question about how you know whether you're making any progress on it, I don't know the answer to that. I think I just had an idea in my head about this character, basically a failed or a British writer who's blocked, inserting themselves into a place where exiled writers are in order to feed off the energy that they have, and contaminating the process in the process. That was the starting thought, and then I went from there. And I think like all novelists, I found ending it the hard bit. It wasn't starting isn't all that difficult, I don't think. It's just bringing the damn thing to a conclusion.
And is there there seems like there's a kind of spoof or there's a metaphor about the notion, the nature of journalism itself, possibly, that in order to, that you can never subsume your own ego to be a journalist or a writer of any sort, you have to nick other people's stories, you have to glamorize the other people's truths in order to tell a story yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot in there. I mean, the one of the main characters, the guy who runs the place, I have some fun with him because he's one of these rather po-faced writers, in my opinion, who regard writing as about simplicity and truth. Now, there's something in that, but what on earth does that mean? I mean, I just don't understand how writers who claim that's what's firing them, how they can really justify that to themselves in their own heads. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of just nicking stuff and hearing something and taking something off someone else. And he constantly tells the exiled writers, if they want to get status and so they can stay in this country, the important thing is they must tell their story truthfully. And they don't know what the truth is. And that is, I think, actually a genuine thing. It's incredibly difficult for refugees in this country, confronted with the asylum process, where people are trying to, as it were, tear their story apart to see if they're making it up, to actually even know if they're telling the truth. Tough one.
Early on in the book, there's a bit. I don't want to give people the impression this is all kind of factual and do-goodery, though, because there's kind of a bit of mystery and there's a richness to the writing, which I thought was really came through when you're describing the early days of, I think it's Mr. Stan, and him being born and his mother's kind of reaction to this little child, and first of all being excited, and then they realise he's bent up and disabled, and they use calipers and things to try and pull him apart. It was almost a bit like Salman Rushdie or something, Midnight's Children. There was some kind of something very rich and magical about it as well. So although you're saying it's a critique and in some senses a spoof of this world, there is a kind of tenderness in there as well.
Oh yeah, and I think it's quite funny, and I hope it is in certain places, and it's quite stylistically tricksy, and there's wordplay and that type of thing. I mean, some people find that a bit troubling and have found that difficult, but I did just chuck it all in there. To some extent, I just did that. Fortunately, I had an American editor in particular who managed to curb some of my wilder excesses, but a certain amount of it has stayed in there. And yeah, there is a bit of magic realism in there. There's A bit of people have said, oh, well, it's Orwellian or Kafkaesque. Well, I mean, it's, to some extent it is. But there's other bits that are more...
adjectives.
No, absolutely. But it wasn't particularly in my mind. And some of it is recognisably London in about now. But at other times, it sort of plays with notions of place and time, which particularly from the refugee perspective seemed to me to be right, that they would be in London. But for them, it would be a very strange... If you read it very carefully, you never hear any of the refugee writers actually refer to it as London. They always talk about it as a foreign city. And I that was slightly deliberate to emphasise that out-of-placeness. So all of those elements are in there. And I think one of the absolutely key driving forces for me on this is I've worked on this issue in the arenas of politics, policy and campaigning. And in all of those arenas, one of the things you're trying to do is simplify and clarify the issue to try and find a solution to these problems. And one of the imperatives, apart from just wanting to write a novel, for me writing this novel, was to say, I really don't think this issue lends itself to that process. As it were, just embrace the messiness. If we can just have amusing and engaging conversations about this issue and see it from all different perspectives, we're never really going to resolve it, but that would be better than this poisoned binary debate that we have about migration at the moment.
What's your style of writing? What's your practice of writing? Are you kind of a 9-to-5 at your desk?
Wake up
in fits of sweaty inspiration at 3 a.m, Tim? How does it work? Because there's a lot going on in the novel. You have to be in a certain headspace to write those different in those different styles, I guess.
Well, I'm neither of those two things. I'm certainly not sit down at my desk and start writing at a certain time.
Thanks, Tim. The book is The House of Journalists. It was out last Friday, the 1st of August. And there we have it, episode 213 of The Monocle Weekly, Andrew.
Lucky for some, unlucky for others.
Lucky for us, we're off to go and lie in the sunshine. It's going to be fine. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and Thomas Lewis, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again next week at the same time, maybe with a change of personnel, who knows. So do join us then. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.